stay out of trouble. And as the late John Lewis would say, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Peace. Paul.
I will second that.
News from Neptune.
The right kind of trouble.
We got to try to find some right kind of trouble, right?
It's right there. It's for you.
Huh. Right. I'm going to play some electronic intifada. Is that enough trouble?
That's enough trouble for us.
Okay. Mumia's got a commentary about the real estate deal in the war zone.
Right.
It's a demolition area. He's standing next to the guy that did it, and he's the government that facilitated the demolition of Gaza. It's beyond satire at this point, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ain't nothing funny about it here.
That's for sure. What else am I going to run down? I got Deconstructing Warlandia with Arun Gupta, who actually goes pretty far. He's actually got me feeling uncomfortable. I might have an outtake from yesterday's presentation at the Friday Forum, not from the main speaker, but somebody got up. I guess on campus there's rumors going around that the houses, of the various group, Asian American, Black, even the Afro-American Cultural Center, are possibly being defunded in some way. And apparently it's a rumor that has some basis, but it's not entirely true. And I was going to try and find that outtake while I'm doing this show here. Maybe I won't, but that'll be on Wednesday, the rebroadcast of the Friday Forum. It was about DEI and inclusion for all. The guy they have in charge of DEI is actually a mechanical engineer, and I didn't find him very, persuasive in presentation or content, to be mild. But that's Sean Garrick, and you can judge for yourself. The series itself is looking really good. I'll try and run down some of that in the during the show, though it is quite packed. Amy Goodman, of course, has a great commentary, as usual, and it is about the big real estate deal, the Rivierization of Gaza after it's been decimated. Not by people, many have been killed, not 10%, but I don't know, it's approaching that maybe. But the infrastructure certainly is gone. All right, let's hear from Mumi Abu-Jamal about SAME. I actually haven't even heard this commentary, but it should be radio worthy. This is from Prison Radio, prisonradio.org, I believe is the website where you can find his commentaries and many other inmates in the penal carceral state we're living in are trying to find their voices. It was great that Leonard Peltier was consigned to house arrest, commutation. He wasn't freed. He has to stay in his house. He's so ill that it's not likely he'd be doing a lot of sojourns, but at least people can come and visit him and give their... Oh, well, here's Mumia, political prisoner extraordinaire, in my opinion. And opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. That was a great show with Nina Turner.
The betrayal of Gaza, again. It was, by any measure, a stunning moment. An American president, essentially, offering to gentrify the Gaza Strip, suggesting that they, should they resist, be forced to leave their historical homeland by the armed forces of the United States. They're living in hell, Trump said, as he sat next to the man who ordered that hell bombed into hell, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump said these coastal lands could be made into a lovely kind of Riviera. It'd be beautiful, he said. Netanyahu beamed at every word. And while Trump saw it as a grand real estate deal, perhaps, Netanyahu saw it as the ultimate Zionist dream. Palestinians saw it as the ultimate nightmare. For they had lived for the better part of a century with political betrayal since Israel's founding in 1948. For over 70 years, they have lived under an occupation that the UN has called illegal. But that doesn't mean a thing. Now, the U.S. is touting an illegal removal of Palestinians, millions of them, from their own homeland. Is this the gentrification of Gaza? Probably not. But who can really say? Who indeed? We can only hope that Palestinians have the last word. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Trump proposes ethnic cleansing of Gaza to build Riviera of the Middle East. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
We'll own it.
President Donald Trump announced at a news conference this week, speaking about Gaza, standing next to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the White House. Trump's stunning declaration,
"The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip,"
was not off the cuff, but read from prepared notes. Palestinians who live there would have to leave, Trump said, seemingly unconcerned he was proposing ethnic cleansing on a massive scale in clear violation of international law.
Everybody I've spoken to loves the idea of the United States owning that piece of land.
Trump continued,
"I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy, but the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so this could be so magnificent."
Trump's son-in-law, former White House advisor Jared Kushner, also a real estate developer, made similar comments a year ago at a Harvard panel on the Middle East. Kushner said,
"And Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable."
President Trump foreshadowed this week's proposal while speaking to the press aboard Air Force One on January 25th.
"I'd like Egypt to take people, and I'd like Jordan to take people. I mean, you're talking about probably 1.5 million people, and we just clean out that whole thing."
While hard-right Israelis are thrilled with Trump's proposed ethnic cleansing, Arab governments were quick to reject it. Saudi Arabia released a statement saying it, quote, "will continue its relentless efforts to establish an independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital and will not establish diplomatic relations with Israel without that," unquote. Egypt and Jordan also flatly rejected the plan, at least for now. Trump has invited King Abdullah of Jordan to visit Washington in the next few weeks. And just this week, the Pentagon approved a $300 million weapons sale to Egypt. Perhaps most adamant are the Palestinians in Gaza themselves. More than 75 years after the Nakba, when many Palestinians were driven from their homes into Gaza, and for more than a half century since 1967 of direct Israeli occupation, siege, and its repeated assaults, Palestinians in Gaza still demand control of their land. Standing before a mountain of rubble in Khan Yunis, a young Palestinian named Yasser Safi said,
"We got out of wreckage, destruction, and a war of attrition, a genocide in which we don't know when death will come to us from all directions. But we stayed, held on, and remained until the last breath. This president, who is called Donald Trump, comes to us with a new method to displace us from our country where we are rooted. This is our land. We will not get out of it. If you refuse that there would be rebuilding, life, or future, and you come up with another idea in which Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, or others call for us to get displaced, this is absolutely refused. Even if you fight us with our food or our rebuilding, and you can see this wreckage here, here we set up a tent on the rubble."
It's unclear if Trump really means to perpetrate this crime or is simply deploying the madman theory. That was a negotiating tactic used by President Richard Nixon during the Vietnam War in an attempt to convince the North Vietnamese that he might in fact be so crazy as to use nuclear weapons, thus forcing them to a peace settlement. It didn't work for Nixon, and it has scant chance of working for Trump. But many who worked in Trump's first administration have warned we should take Trump at his word. He might very well try to drive 2 million Palestinians from Gaza into Egypt's Sinai Desert or to Jordan to, quote, clean out Gaza, to build the magnificent Riviera he imagines and that he no doubt would personally profit from as well. Trump's zealous lawbreaking is now on full display domestically in his unprecedented assault on the very structures of the U.S. government, ordering mass retaliatory firings, shutdowns of entire departments, orchestrating an abhorrent attack on trans people, and more. Another president who had profoundly more experience with and insight into the Israel-Palestine conflict than Trump was Jimmy Carter, who brokered the 1978 Camp David Accords, establishing peace between Israel and Egypt. In his 2006 book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, Carter wrote of Israel's oppression of Palestinians,
utilizing their political and military dominance, they are imposing a system of partial withdrawal, encapsulation, and apartheid on the Muslim and Christian citizens of the occupied territories. The driving purpose of the forced separation of the two peoples is unlike that in South Africa, not racism, but the acquisition of land.
President Carter, who died at 100 on December 29th, took enormous heat in 2006 for using the word apartheid in reference to Israel, but never backed down. 20 years later, Israel's widely condemned as an apartheid state. With Trump in the White House, Israel no doubt sees a rare opportunity to grab the entire Gaza Strip. It will take a mass movement, global in scale, to stop this crime before it happens. I am Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And we'll have some more from Amy in the part form of a web exclusive. She had an author of Teaching Truth on Hagopian rhymes with utopian. Well, and I didn't say it wrong, I guess. It was pretty neat, and I think in a college or university community, and a lot of what's going on now is the suppression of education, it seems to me. He's with the Zinn Project. I haven't heard anybody invoke Howard Zinn's name in a while, so I want to return to that. But since we're on the subject of the Gaza and, well, West Bank too, occupied territories, I thought we could hear something from the Electronic Intifada. This is also because this is one of the co-founders, Nora Barris Friedman. Her colleague who lives in Chicago and I'm doing a brain fade on his name. He was deported from Switzerland where he was supposed to give a talk. I'm still not remembering his name. Anyway, the two principals of the Electronic Intifada. I doubt whether if she was giving a talk in Switzerland, she probably would have been deported. Maybe they would have found another way to cancel the venue or something like happens when controversial people talk about books and stuff, books that were happened to Max Blumenthal, his book, Management of Savagery. Manufacturing Consent, of course, is Chomsky's book. News from Neptune comes from an anecdote about Chomsky, but I'm meandering here, and I'll just meander over to the book about history of anti-Zionism by Professor Balthizer, who is at in the Indiana University, and I faded on that one too. Ali Abu Nima is the other person with the Electronic Intifada, and Amy Goodman covered that well this week. I'm not doing anything about immigration particularly explicitly. I commend your attention to Democracy Now!, which will cover the mayors going to the House. Brandon, the real Brandon, from mayor of Chicago, is being called in on Tuesday to talk about the sanctuary city aspect. I don't know if they're going to call Pritzker in to talk about the Safety Act. Probably don't want to give him the attention. And they probably can't, anyway, speculate about that. Already 15 minutes into the show, so I'm editing on the fly here. I might edit a bit of this news roundup from Nora Barris Friedman from the Electric Intifada. You can find it on your usual podcast, unless it's been suppressed. I don't know. I don't think it has yet.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barris Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 19 of the ceasefire after 15 months of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Despite the ceasefire, Israeli forces still in the south of the Gaza Strip killed two Palestinians in Rafah on Wednesday. A child was shot in the chest by an Israeli sniper in central Rafah, hours after occupation forces opened fire at civilians in eastern Khan Yunus, killing a man. As people continue to return to their homes in the north and the south, the local government and human rights groups say that Israel is not fulfilling its obligations under the ceasefire agreement regarding the entry of necessary humanitarian relief and shelter aid. Access to safe water, especially in the north, is still a daily struggle, and Palestinians are still unable to procure adequate temporary shelters and materials to protect themselves from the winter cold. The Gaza government media office stated on February 3rd that according to the ceasefire protocol, quote, 60,000 caravans and 200,000 temporary tents were supposed to be brought into the Gaza Strip to accommodate the displaced people of our honorable Palestinian people whose homes, housing units, and residential neighborhoods were destroyed by the Israeli occupation. 600 trucks containing aid and fuel are also supposed to enter each day, the media office said, in addition to medical and health services and equipment, quote, necessary to rehabilitate humanitarian services in the Gaza Strip. However, the government media office says the Israeli occupation is creating obstacles and procrastinating in the implementation of this agreement, quote, which exacerbates the humanitarian crisis and doubles the suffering of the civilian population in the Gaza Strip, and this will have serious and unprecedented repercussions and effects. Euromed Human Rights Monitor says that the humanitarian situation has not improved since the ceasefire was implemented on January 19th. In a report, the human rights group says that, quote, nearly all forms of aid remain disrupted, and the urgent humanitarian needs of the Strip's roughly 2.3 million residents have not been met. Though the number of trucks entering the Gaza Strip has increased, Euromed says, their preliminary analysis of the volume and type of aid entering the enclave reveals that some of it are non-essential items. The rights group adds that only about 35% of the 8,500 trucks that have been let in since the ceasefire have been able to enter northern Gaza. Medical devices and essential equipment needed to resume hospital operations, such as MRI machines, have not yet arrived in Gaza. In terms of necessary municipal infrastructure, Euromed Human Rights Monitor says that about 85% of the water wells in Gaza have been destroyed, and Israel has forbidden the importation of supplies to repair and restore them. According to estimates from the Gaza municipality and the northern Gaza Strip municipalities, 100 wells in the northern Gaza Valley need to be restored and repaired immediately. None have been fixed thus far, Euromed says. The health sector, meanwhile, remains in ruins. Izzedine Lulu, a medical student, filmed himself walking through the wreckage of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, this week.
Hello everyone, it's Izzedine Lulu, a 6th year medical student from northern Gaza. This is our first time entering Kamal Adwan Hospital since the Israeli forces raided and occupied this hospital. This is where doctors and medical staff made their last stand and where patients found refuge away from the bombs of the occupation until it was too late. As you see, there is so much destruction made to the hospital. It will take a lot of time and effort to rebuild. For now, we Gazans are trying to assess how we can move in into rebuilding our beloved Gaza, inshallah.
That was Izzedine Lulu, a 6th-year medical student. Kamal Adwan's director, the pediatrician Hassam Abu Safiya, is still in Israeli detention at the Ofer military prison and continues to be denied access to a lawyer. The Rafah crossing nominally reopened this past week for patients in Gaza needing medical evacuation. The United Nations says that there are between 12,000 and 14,000 patients needing to access care outside of Gaza, but only a few dozen Palestinians have been medically evacuated through the Rafah crossing as of Wednesday. International fugitive and war crimes suspect Benjamin Netanyahu was welcomed to the White House this week, where President Donald Trump asserted that the U.S. will, quote, own Gaza, and claimed that he has plans to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from Gaza while it is rebuilt, similar plans to those asserted by former U.S. President Joe Biden and his Secretary of State Antony Blinken during the 15-month genocide. Palestinian human rights groups and Palestinian civil society have broadly rebuked these statements. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima posted on Twitter/X that, quote, there is no plan and, more importantly, no means for an American occupation and annexation of Gaza. Donald Trump will not will into existence what 15 months of unlimited Biden-armed Israeli barbarity failed to produce. The rights group Al-Haq stated on Wednesday that, quote, instead of supporting rebuilding efforts at scale to reconstitute what Israel's genocidal machinery has destroyed, the U.S. administration has announced its clear participation in Israel's genocide in Gaza, the latest plan in the ongoing Nakba, intended to fragment and destroy the Palestinian people and deny Palestinians their inalienable right to self-determination. Al-Haq adds, quote, we emphasize that the only plan that should be on the table following the ceasefire is one that upholds the rights of the Palestinian people of self-determination and return. This entails the rights of the Palestinians in Gaza to choose their own future, remain in their land, and rebuild it. Trump's suggestion of forcible displacement to end the death and destruction in Gaza is telling of the U.S. administration's complicity and direct participation in the genocide. It is further a violation of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination, fueling the ongoing Nakba of the Palestinian people. We warn that Trump's administration is a serious threat to not only the Palestinian people, but all of humanity. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of Gaza's Poets Never Stopped Writing by Abdullah Yunus, writing from Gaza. Abdullah reports on a poetry reading in Deir Abala in central Gaza that took place just a few weeks before the ceasefire. Since October 2023, Abdullah writes, Israel has killed an unknowable number of poets and writers. Estimates of those killed are available, and they vary depending on the source. But the extent of the carnage wrought on Gaza's literary community is something that will never be known. Poet Basil Abu al-Sheikh leaned forward in his chair toward a crowd of about 50 people to recite his poem. It was late December, and we had gathered in this camp west of Deir Abala in central Gaza to listen to the works of those poets present. The sun was setting and the tents glowed orange as a cold breeze reminded us of the harshness of displacement in winter. The Israeli occupation planes and drones could be heard above us. Some of those gathered sat on the ground, covering themselves with worn blankets or burlap sacks, while others sat on plastic chairs. Abu al-Sheikh recited his poem in a defiant yet sad tone. The shackles have wounded my heart, not my wrists, and the night has made my eyes sleepless like the stars. Neither tears nor blood are enough, and I no longer know whether my tears or blood have flowed. Abu al-Sheikh, 55, the author of the novel Palestinian Sorrows, was one of several poets who had helped organize the reading. He said he had hoped the gathering would provide a space for expression among the displaced in the camp, something to help them make sense of the long months of horrors inflicted on the Palestinians in Gaza. He said that the poem he read was about his arrest by the Israeli army in December 2023 and his imprisonment for 4 months. At the time, Abu al-Sheikh lived in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza with his family of six. The family had sought shelter at the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, further north, during Israeli bombings. Yet Abu al-Sheikh was arrested from the hospital and would not be released from Israeli imprisonment until March 2024. While in prison, Abu al-Sheikh was tortured mentally and physically, yet the worst of it still awaited him. Upon his release, he was prevented from returning to his family by the Israeli military and was forced to head south. There, he learned that his eldest son had been killed in an Israeli airstrike in January 2024. Since then, Abu al-Sheikh has lived in the camp in a tent alone. Poets and writers give people hope and encourage them to endure the tragedies of war, he said. That's an excerpt from Abdullah Yunus's feature, Gaza's Poets Never Stopped Writing, on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, dozens of Palestinians have been killed in the northern city of Jenin and the Jenin refugee camp as Israel's raid and siege of the area entered its third consecutive week. Raids and assaults by Israeli forces in nearby towns and villages have also expanded. In Tulkarem, Israeli attacks have displaced approximately 75% of Palestinians from their homes in the Tulkarem refugee camp, while Israeli forces have prevented the entry of medicine, food, and essential supplies, according to local officials. My colleague Tamara Nassar reports that, quote, the Israeli military carried out several aerial bombardments in densely populated civilian areas and caused widespread destruction of infrastructure and homes across Jenin camp that Reuters said was, quote, on a scale not seen there for over 20 years. Israeli troops bulldozed all the roads leading to Jenin refugee camp and the city, as well as a number of roads within them. The vast majority of camp residents have been displaced under Israeli orders, some of them even searched and arrested on the way out of the camp. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq stated that the remaining families are living in grave danger with no access to water, electricity, and other basic services. At least 150 homes in Jenin have been severely damaged by the Israeli attack, according to the UN. Tamara adds that on February 1st, the Israeli military razed nearly two dozen buildings in simultaneous bombings. Juliet Tuma from the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, said that the detonations happened, quote, when children were supposed to go back to school. She added that 13 schools in the camp and nearby areas are shuttered, affecting 5,000 children. The UN agency's services in the camp have been interrupted for months and had to be completely halted in early December during the assault by the Palestinian Authority. UNRWA apparently had no warning of the detonations, as there is no longer contact between its staff and the Israeli military since Israel shuttered the agency's operations last month. The Wall Street Journal reported that the bombings resembled a tactic used in Gaza, where the Israeli military created corridors to divide the enclave. An Israeli attack decapitated a 14-year-old boy in Jenin on the same day, Tamara reports. A missile that Israel fired from a drone without warning killed Ahmad Abdel Hakim Saadi while he was in the courtyard outside his family's home, according to a field investigation by Defense for Children International Palestine. There was no presence of Israeli troops in the immediate area at the time. Israeli forces have killed at least 11 Palestinian children in the West Bank since the start of the year, 7 by drone strikes and 4 others by live ammunition. This toll does not include 3 Palestinian children killed during the Palestinian Authority's raid on the Jenin refugee camp, which started in the first week of December and concluded in January. For more on the situation in Jenin, read Tamara Nassar's report, Israeli Genocidal Violence Reaches West Bank, on electronicintifada.net. And in the southern occupied West Bank, meanwhile, heavily armed Israeli settlers have attacked areas including Masafer Yatta near Al-Khalil. Activist, journalist, and filmmaker Basil Adra filmed the settler attack in Masafer Yatta on Monday evening. He stated that the settlers smashed and destroyed Palestinians' cars, attacked homes, and damaged water tanks. Finally, as we always do, we wanted to share people expressing determination and resilience in the aftermath of Israel's 15-month campaign of destruction. In northern Gaza, a man responds to Donald Trump's absurd claims about Gaza. Quote, "They're saying that Trump wants to forcibly displace Gaza's people," he says. "Gaza's people here are digging a well, and they are rebuilding Gaza from scratch. I swear you have your work cut out for you with Gazawis, and you're in for a long ride. You're in for a long ride," he says. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
And that was Nora Barrows Friedman. Always like to have a Jewish voice for peace, since people have been in a variety of ways attacking my motivations, I guess. I would just give me some truth. Speaking of that, that's in the title of the book of the fellow that was on Democracy Now!, Jesse Hagopian, rhymes with utopian. I think I got closer that time. They did an on-air interview, and this is at least a bit of the off-air interview. I want to get Arun Gupta's Deconstructing Racism. I don't know if it's a freestanding podcast. It's an occasional feature on Flashpoints at KPFA with Dennis Bernstein, and pretty wide-ranging from what I've listened to of it. here's more of a thought piece on how we got here, the miseducation of the USA, I guess I'll call it. As you'll hear here, Hagopian is on the leadership team of the Zinn Project, Howard Zinn. Missing him now, the bombardier.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to part two of our interview with Jesse Hagopian, longtime educator and high school teacher in Seattle, whose new book is titled Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. Jesse is on the leadership team of the Zinn Education Project, which draws on historian Howard Zinn's influential book, A People's History of the United States. And he serves on the National Steering Committee of Black Lives Matter at School.
Jesse,
Your recent article for The Nation is headlined, "The Far Right's Plan to Force Teachers to Lie About Race." I wanted to go to this issue even before President Trump was reelected. You have states across the country that have introduced and passed legislation that force teachers to change their curricula. For example, Florida, where teachers are required to say chattel slavery in the U.S. was beneficial because it taught them useful skills. Can you, first of all, talk specifically about what they're supposed to teach and then respond to this?
Yes, it's an astounding situation in our country right now, where even before Trump took office, almost half of all public school children are subjected to laws that require their teacher to lie to them about racism, Black history, gender, Indigenous history, oppression, and just so much of U.S. history. I call these laws truth crime laws because they criminalize honest education. And the fact is, the impact goes far beyond just where states have passed these laws, because the fear of retribution for teaching the truth has created such a chilling effect that's just so cold that an incredible 2 out of every 3 teachers in this country report self-censoring around discussions of race, gender, and sexuality. This is the new McCarthyism, where teachers are scared to teach the truth because many have been attacked and fired. Many have faced death threats sent to them. And really, I think that we have to consider the reality of what's happening now, imposing what we could call post-truth schooling in present-day America. And I think in the boundless satire that is the United States of America, you have a situation where Juneteenth, the oldest commemoration of ending slavery, became a federal holiday at the same time that legislators were making it a truth crime to teach about the origins of the commemoration and why that commemoration was needed, including in Texas, where the holiday originates, right? And the situation in Florida is completely off the rails. When the official state curriculum in Florida says that slavery was of, quote, personal benefit to Black people, we know that we are rapidly returning to the age of Jim Crow and the Confederacy. And, you know, in Florida, teachers sent home permission slips with students to get permission to read books by Black authors. That is how much they fear retribution. But I do want to stress that this isn't just in Florida. It isn't just in the South. It's not just in red states. This is all across the U.S., even in California, where it's not likely to pass at a state level to have this kind of a ban. You nevertheless have some 110,000 students across the state in different local school districts that are governed by similar laws as those in Florida. And here's the thing, you cannot ban your way to knowledge. You can't ban your way to truth and justice and freedom, right? We have to allow school to be a place of critical inquiry, of creativity and imagination. And to do that, we have to defend students' right to learn.
So, Jesse, if you could just situate this in the broader history of American public school education, when would you say, as you call it, a truth crime? When do you think these elisions, these erasures of U.S. history began being taught in schools, or when certain kinds of history was taken away from the curriculum by force, by the state?
Well, I think we need to go all the way back to 1739, when the first anti-literacy laws were imposed in South Carolina as a reaction to the Stono Rebellion that happened in 1739. And, you know, a man named Jemmy led an uprising in South Carolina against slavery, and they marched with a banner that said liberty. And the following year in South Carolina, they not only put down that rebellion, they banned the ability for people, for Black folks to ever write that word again. And we know that after the Civil War, Black people built the first truly public schools in this country open to all. And the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacists attacked those schools. They burned down over 600 Black schools during Reconstruction. And we know that organizations like Daughters of the Confederacy worked tirelessly in the Jim Crow era to extend the lost cause narrative that glorified the Confederacy. We had the Dunning School out of Columbia University that was all about trying to claim that Reconstruction was a failure because of black domination of the government. And that extends all the way up into modern times when textbook companies like McGraw-Hill claimed that workers, quote, workers were brought over from Africa to work on plantations, not mentioning that they were enslaved and unpaid in their geography textbook, right? These are common practices that are about erasing honest history and replacing it with what I call uncritical race theory, the uncritical examination of U.S. history, the uncritical examination of race and the rejection of any systemic understanding of where racism comes from.
Jesse, can you talk about your experience in the classroom? You cite in your Nation piece the Washington Post identifying at least 160 educators who lost their jobs or had to resign because they taught about race or LGBTQ issues this was as of June 2022. Talk about the pressures people are facing and this whole notion of obeying in advance. Do you find that teachers are changing because they're afraid?
Yeah, the attack is hard to overstate. I have a friend, Melissa Temple, who taught first grade in a school in Wisconsin, and her students wanted to sing a song for a musical production that they were doing, Rainbowland. This isn't a radical anthem. This is a pop song by Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton that talks about creating a world where everyone can be themselves. It doesn't even mention LGBTQ plus identity. And yet the principal banned the students from being able to sing that song, and the school district upheld that. And Melissa, on her own time at home on a Friday, sent a tweet out saying that she believed her kids had the right to sing that song. They practiced it, they chose it, they wanted to sing it. And she came to school on a Monday, and there was a police officer in the office with a representative from HR that escorted her out of the building. She was fired, and she never had a chance to say goodbye to her young students.
In fact, Jesse, we had Melissa Temple on the air after she was fired. This is a part of what she said.
My students heard about the song. The music teacher introduced it to them. They had practiced it a few times with me. And in our daily morning meetings, the person of the day gets to lead the meeting, and then they get to pick a song. And so Rainbowland was the song that they wanted to pick just one or two times before I was put on leave. When I was told that we couldn't sing it anymore, I wanted to just make a point that when I tweeted about it, my students were obviously devastated. They loved the song. They had gotten used to it. But I didn't view what I was doing as making a complaint. You know, the song had already been taken out of the program. The music teacher was conducting the program. It wasn't part of my specific job duties. But in addition to that, it was really horrifying to know that a school district's non-discrimination, our controversial content policy, would go so far as to say that we couldn't sing Rainbowland. So that's why I knew people were going to be interested to find out that that had happened. And I knew that it was going to create a lot of public discussion. And I think that's exactly what it did.
Well, what was the response, Melissa? Could you elaborate on that?
Overwhelmingly, surprise, shock. People were saying, what's wrong with the lyrics? What's wrong with the song? I mean, I had a dollar for every time somebody said, well, I listened to the song and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with it or why they didn't like it. You know, it's a really wholesome song. I equate it to any other song that we would sing. In fact, I would say Rainbowland is ultimately even more of a first grade song than something like Rainbow Connection, because the message is just such a great piece and, like, you know, coming together song about acceptance.
That was the fired first grade teacher, Melissa Temple. Jesse Hagopian, go on.
You know, in Florida, Amy Donofrio was fired when she taught at Robert E. Lee High School, a high school named after a murderous white supremacist. And she put up a Black Lives Matter flag in her classroom to let her black students know they were cared for and supported in that room. And she was fired and made an example by the governor there. We have Matthew Hahn in Tennessee, who taught a lesson about white privilege, right? And assigned an essay by award-winning author Ta-Nehisi Coates, and was fired for allowing kids to think critically about race. These are the types of attacks that are being replicated across the country and creating a chilling effect. And yet, as we detail in the journal I help to edit, Rethinking Schools, there is a great rebellion occurring of educators and parents and students across this country who are refusing to give in to the fear and the lies. And they're practicing what Jarvis Givens titles fugitive pedagogy. They're teaching the truth anyway, regardless of laws that try to impose this kind of conformity on them. And on June 7th, we have our National Teach Truth Day of Action. So teachers are building for that all across the country as they have the past 4 years. And right now we're in the midst of Black Lives Matter at School Week, where thousands of educators across the country are teaching lessons about the Black freedom struggle. And in defiance of these outrageous laws trying to ban the truth.
Jesse Hagopian, you write in the preface of your book, Teach Truth, A Promise to My Ancestors. Talk about your ancestors.
Yeah, as I began writing this book in 2021, my dad made a stunning discovery. He found out which plantation our family had been enslaved on in Morgantown, Mississippi, and Lawrence County, Mississippi. And it really changed my life and my family's life forever. And we knew we had to get down to that plantation. And after some setbacks, we finally made it down there. And we were fortunate enough to run into the man that currently owns the land that had been the plantation our family had been enslaved on. And he showed us a clearing where there was a gravesite where our ancestors had buried each other. And at that gravesite, we held a ceremony to honor them, where I made a promise to my ancestors, to my enslaved ancestors there, Thomas Lenoir and Laura Ratcliffe Lenoir, that we would never lie about the slavery, the cruelty that they had endured, or the beautiful radical resistance that they had engaged in to resist slavery, and that we would tell the truth about their story to everybody that we encounter. And you know, that book and being here with you today is part of fulfilling my promise to my ancestors.
Well, Jesse, if you could talk about your book in the context also of what you say is uncritical race theory, and how that is kind of the substitute for what happens if you don't teach critical race theory.
Yeah, I mean, conversations in the mainstream media today about education are replete with discussions about critical race theory. But I think the real problem in education is uncritical race theory, right? And uncritical race theory is a whitewashed version of history that erases systemic racism, resistance, and struggle. It teaches us that the civil rights movement ended what little racism there was in the United States. Uncritical race theory teaches us that the U.S. was founded on equity and you know, principles of democracy alone, and denies the genocide of Native Americans, the enslavement of my ancestors and so many millions of other African people. And really, uncritical race theorists demand an anodyne telling of history where the United States was simply delivered by the stork, and they'd rather not look any further into how the country was actually made, lest it offend delicate sensibilities. So we see uncritical race theory embedded in too many corporate textbooks that really push a system of thought that teaches that slavery was just incidental to American history rather than central to the American economy. And we have to work to replace uncritical race theory, this uncritical examination of history, with traditions like ethnic studies that try to center all of our students' backgrounds and understand how race was created in this country and perpetuates systemic racism today. We need to be able to teach Black studies and cultural studies to our youth so that every kid can see themselves in the classroom and understand the contributions of people that look like them to the classroom.
As we begin to wrap up, Jesse, if you can talk more about what you mean by anti-racist education, and talk about the movement in this country where people can tap into it. Of course, the direction of the mainstream of the administration right now is exactly to eradicate that. But talk about its rich history.
Yeah. Well, when we say we want anti-racist education in the classroom, we know that uncritical race theorists immediately reply that that's about shaming white kids. Right, as if all of us social justice educators got into teaching in order to shame any children. It's an outrageous lie. And in fact, that's not really what they fear. They know we're not shaming white children. What they really fear is that We are empowering white children by teaching them about the history of people like the Grimke sisters, who were abolitionists organizing to end slavery, or John Brown, or Howard Zinn, or Ann Braden, or so many other important white freedom fighters who joined in multiracial struggles against systemic racism in this country. And so anti-racist teaching is about understanding that for too long our textbooks have distorted the story of the American past to erase the struggles and contributions of Black people, of Indigenous people, and people of color, and that those stories need to be put back in because they're some of the most inspiring, incredible stories of the struggle for democracy and freedom. And that if we are going to create a society worthy of our children, we're going to need to learn the lessons of how those social movements were created and learn how to implement those lessons today. And that's exactly what they fear. And I'll just end with a story of how that works. When I first began teaching high school, you know, I was teaching AP US history, and I was using many lessons from the Zinn Education Project, teaching kids about the Seneca Falls Convention, the first women's rights conference to discuss the fight for women's suffrage. We were doing lessons about the abolitionist movement, where all the students actually became members of different abolitionist organizations and then had to debate the best methods for ending slavery. Or they were members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and had to debate how to end Jim Crow segregation. And the students who went through my course learning about the social movements in the world were truly put to the test, a test far greater than the AP exam the following year, when the state legislature voted to cut billions of dollars from the education budget. And myself and a group of social justice educators went to the state legislature. We protested. We read out the state constitution that demands that education is the paramount duty of our state. And I even attempted to do a citizen's arrest of the state legislature for violating our state constitution. And lo and behold, the officer in the room arrested me instead of the state legislature. Well, my students, who had been empowered with the knowledge of social movements, led a walkout against the budget cuts when they learned of my arrest, and demanded an audience with the mayor, and were part of an uprising across the city and state that helped win billions more for our schools. And that's exactly what the uncritical race theorists fear, is an informed youth that knows the lessons of history so they can apply them to today.
Jesse Hagopian, we want to thank you for being with us. Longtime educator, high school teacher in Seattle, Washington. He has a new book out. It's titled Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. Jesse's on the leadership team of the Zinn Education Project and serves on the National Steering Committee of Black Lives Matter at School. We'll also link to your Nation article headlined The Far Right's Plan to Force Teachers to Lie About Race. To see part one of our discussion about President Trump's plans to dismantle the Department of Education, go to democracynow.org. As well, see our interview with Melissa Temple, the first grade teacher Jesse was talking about, who was fired for a viral tweet in which she criticized her Wisconsin Board of Education's decision to ban her students from singing Rainbow Land during a school concert. That song, Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Okay, that was the web exclusive, the unaired interview with Hagopian of the Zinn Project. There's another word in there, but I don't know what it is. I did mention the Friday Forum Conversation Cafe. Who says there's no free lunch? There is every Friday at the YMCA. That happens to be the Valentine's Day Friday Forum. Democratic Erosion and Women's Political Power: Perspectives from Europe. Saskia Breckenmacher, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Maybe she takes their money and subverts it. Here's an underwriting announcement, which I've been blanking on. I'm going to get a couple more in before, and then we are going to hear at least a little bit of Arun Gupta's Deconstructing Warlandia segment from Dennis Bernstein's Flashpoints. If you don't get to hear it all, or if I don't get it all on the air, it's coming, or you can find it there or something. Here's one of our stalwart small businesses, and
one whose services I probably need.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces, .com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
They don't have a clue about how to deal with Trump.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And case in point is the show, the clown show this week with his fellow fascist and supremacist, Benjamin Netanyahu, where Trump announced that the U.S. was going to take over Gaza and turn it into a new Riviera. And really, it was just the reaction was clueless at best, if not utterly appalling. And I do want to single out one particularly horrific pundit, Dana Milbank, with the Washington Bezos, I mean Washington Post, who he wrote a piece like, how's a genocide Joe looking now? And basically he ends up insinuating that people who protested against the genocide, wanted the genocide to end, who were disrupting the various campaign rallies, that they helped elect Trump. And, you know, look at what he wants to do now. He said, like, how's that working out for you? And this continues this trend, which I think is really prevalent on the left. Let's not just blame liberals. They tend to be the worst, but of instrumentalizing Palestinians. As really, this is what we saw for over a year from the left. You can look at the left media. There are some exceptions. But talking about the genocide in terms of how it affected the 2024 elections. And, you know, I think at this point it's fair to say, to call this the Palestinian Holocaust, because the damage, destruction, death, the horror, the torture was so devastating, was so pervasive. I've seen one report, I don't know if it's been verified, so, you know, take it with a pinch of salt, but that apparently 17,000 corpses had been removed from the rubble. You know, we had this death toll that was basically stuck at 40,000 for the last year, because what Israel did was destroy the infrastructure. But there was estimates from all these doctors who went to Gaza. They issued a letter to Biden last September saying they believed that death toll was minimum 100,000. So this is a Holocaust. And the reaction to Trump's comments is to use it as a cudgel to beat people. And this includes hundreds of thousands of Palestinian, Muslim, Arab Americans who are seeing their families slaughtered, right? You know, there's these reports coming out. Obviously, it's the worst in Gaza, but in the United States, that people who've lost 50, 100, over 200 relatives, you know, entire bloodlines wiped out. And the response is to beat people over the head. And the thing is, this was just horrible politics in every way, because what Trump said was so absurd and outrageous. If you follow the Middle East, and anyone on the left should, right? The Palestinian question is really has been one of the most pressing questions, most important questions, not just for the left, but for the world, for the last 50 to 60 years, the liberation of Palestine. It's a last anti-colonial struggle. It's the center of Middle East geopolitics, which is just the most volatile region in the world because of the intersection of oil and natural gas, hydrocarbons, as well as trade, the population, religion, and most of all, Western imperialism and colonialism. And so we should be past this awful instrumentalization of the Palestinians. What Trump said was, we all knew, or at least those of us who actually follow and care what's going on in the region, knew that this was just a bunch of hooey, that it was just hot air. It was as ridiculous as when in his first term he talked about using nuclear bombs to stop hurricanes or injecting bleach into people to kill COVID. This is never going to happen. All you need to do is just think it through for half a minute. And so, first of all, who's going to do this? Is the United States going to do this? And no, that's absurd. You know, it's the Palestinian resistance survived 15 months of genocide. You know, the moment the ceasefire's ended and this deal is struck for Israeli hostages to be released in return for stopping the bombing, letting in food aid, releasing a couple thousand Palestinian prisoners, we see Hamas come out in force, you know, with brand new vehicles in these events, you know, where they put the Israeli prisoners in new, brand new uniforms who are not looking much worse for the wear, given that what Israel was doing for the last 15 months. And Hamas was showing that they are still in control. And Blinken, you know, the butcher of Gaza, Secretary of State, he admitted, like, you know, weeks before his shameful tenure ended, that Hamas has basically replenished his ranks. You know, the idea of defeating the resistance is absurd, you know, even though that's what the Biden administration ghouls were trying to do for a year. It's as ridiculous as, you know, trying to defeat terrorism, the war on terrorism. And so what Trump said, none of it takes into account the actual reality. So this kind of like everyone running around like chickens with their heads cut off shows they still do not understand how to respond to Trump after he's been on the scene for a decade. First and foremost, the Palestinians are going to have something to say to this. And if you saw all these reports, whether in the media or better social media, especially TikTok, of Palestinians responding directly to Trump, you know, they're saying, you know, you think we're going to leave after we survived 15 months of this genocide, of this devastation? You think we're going to leave now? You know, where they're saying, like, what more could you do to this us that hasn't been done already? Or, you know, saying, like, you know, this is our land. This is where we were born. This is our culture. This is, we will never leave, right? But on top of that, you also have Middle Eastern politics. Even trying to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza. First of all, that's going to be virtually impossible. Even if it was successful, where do you send them? Well, Trump said Jordan and Egypt. This would completely destabilize Jordan, probably result in the fall of the Hashemite dynasty, which is, you know, basically a subsidiary of the CIA, because Jordan is already two-thirds Palestinian. Trump also wanted to send a bunch to Egypt, and this would destabilize Egypt as well, which is really the fulcrum of power in the Middle East, given where it sits, the size of its population, its geostrategic importance. On top of that, you had Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, immediately coming out, you know, saying, like, no way this will never happen. And he has no love of the Palestinians, but his whole legitimacy is based on appealing to Arab youth in Saudi Arabia and throughout the whole region. And for the last 15 months, Arab youth have been completely outraged and aghast at the genocide. So to think that Saudi Arabia is going to sign on is also ridiculous. And within 24 hours, you see the Trump administration walking back what Trump had to say. You know, that it's just like, oh, he's not really talking about sending troops there. You know, the U.S. is not going to commit any money to this. Well, who's going to fund it? The Qataris aren't going to fund it. The Saudis, UAE, none of them are going to fund it. So this is just Trump being a clown, trying to keep himself at the center of the spotlight. And that's how the media should be treating him instead of giving him all this power. So yet again,
but just to belittle, he put the idea in the flow, and you have all these corporate journalists taking this crap seriously and analyzing and getting guests from Israel. Everybody in the world has been interviewed about this, except not one single Palestinian has made it onto the corporate media.
Yeah, exactly. You know, again, it's just treating Palestinians like objects, and just there's something to be you know, brushed aside, or that they don't have any say in this whatsoever. You know, there was a funny passage in the New York Times where they used something like 20 words to basically describe imperialism, because of course they are incapable of saying what imperialism is. And when they were reporting on what Trump had to say, what they said is control over Gaza has been one of the major flashpoints of the Arab-Israeli conflict for decades. And here's where they describe what imperialism is, but instead of using the term imperialism, the idea of relocating its Palestinian residents recalls an era when great Western powers redrew the maps of the region and moved around populations without regard to local autonomy. I mean, that is just such convoluted writing, because you have a corporate media that cannot admit reality, right? They cannot admit that Trump is essentially a white nationalist autocrat who has this almost what is a co-presidency with apartheid Barbie, aka Elon Musk, you know, and they If this was happening in some place in, you know, Africa, the media would be just dripping with derision and contempt for these clownish, violent dictators. That's how they should be treating Trump, but they're incapable of it.
Incapable. Well, we got about a minute left, but we don't see. Trump did walk it back, and he also talked about how it's, you know, he's going to let the Israelis are going to finish it up, and then they're going to hand the keys to Gaza to the Americans. Trump's not sending any troops now. But where does this go, and where is this moment taking us?
Well, you know, I think it does create real dangers, right? Netanyahu wants to blow up the peace deal. Now this has imperiled the second round. Interestingly, what Trump did, it backfired because it united the Arab states against him and against Israel. So all this does is create more peril for Israel. But we know when that happens, Israel lashes out violently. It's also, let's not forget, it's building outposts in Syria. So it is basically starting to cement its illegal violent occupation of Syria.
That's Arun Gupta, and he does a series called Deconstructing Warlandia with Dennis Bernstein. You can find the last few seconds of it, but it's time for Kick Out the Jams with
Funkadelics.
Funkadelics, and theming in the full triumvirate. The language is sexist, but yeah. The whole group's here. I'm sorry. I got to go. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting Community Media Opinions. You hear those of the speakers here on WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Do I sound like an announcer?